I want to discuss mainly, or try to explain at least, the relation with the renormalization group and the renormalization calculation and the renormalization group we have been doing here in a context of perturbative quantum field theory, and the concept of renormalization and the renormalization group that you have seen in the statistical mechanics course by David, related to the physics of critical phenomena, because this is a modern way to view renormalization, but it's deeply connected to this old way of looking at renormalization in high energy physics in perturbation theory. But before that, let me just discuss very briefly 2 points about renormalization in perturbation theory. First, I just want to mention that this perturbation theory, perturbative, let's say, renormalization, is a theory which works at all orders in perturbation theory for what's called renormalizable theory. And that's something which is well established since the 50s and the 60s. And the name associated to the proof, the mathematical proof that this works at all order. So this procedure of introducing counter terms and in order to cancel the divergence and to get a finite theory at a finite energy scale can be repeated. It's associated, it's called the BPHZ theorem. So B stands for Bogolyubov, P for Parachuk, so there are two. Bogolyubov is a famous Russian theoretician who worked high energy physics in condensed matter. Parachuk is another one. Hepp is still alive. I think he's a Swiss physicist who turned to biophysics and biology. And Zimmermann was German. So this was the original theory. And this was a more math. Well, they are physicists, but mathematically oriented that completed and established this in general. Okay. So the idea is, in fact, is we have seen that for phi 4 at one loop, you have two diagrams. You have this diagram that diverges like a lambda squared plus a log of lambda. The mass, these are the two divergences, and you have this diagram which behaves like log of lambda. Let's say log of lambda. Okay. By dimension analysis. Those are the two dangerous diagrams. At two loop, we have seen which are the diagrams. You have diagrams that are extension of this one. You see this one, for instance, you have this one. You have this one, and here you have this one. Let's see. You have this one, and you have this one. And you have also this one, I think. Yes. Okay. I think I'm not forgetting anything. Okay. So these are, and those are the only diagrams that are dangerous. Because you may have, for instance, a three-loop diagram, which is like this. Remember, this is, I'm sorry, not a three-loop, a three-leg diagram, which is like this. And you may insert in this diagram something like that. But that's okay. So this kind of diagram are not very dangerous. Well, this because those are, you know, dressings of this. So if you have this kind of divergence, you know how to deal with them. This one and this one. This one is also a bit easy to deal, but this one and this one are more interesting because you see that this diagram is a two-point diagram that contains a four-point diagram, which is divergent. And if you count, if you study this diagram, you can see that this gives log of lambda sub divergence. But there is a global divergence that comes from what's happening when all the momenta inside the diagram are big. And so you have a global divergence, which turns out to be of the form. So remember, this is a lambda squared. So this is also a two-point diagram. So it contains, it's going to contain a lambda squared. It contains an m squared log of lambda. But it turns out that if you have a momentum flowing through this diagram, you know, it will not just flow there and get out. The amplitude of this diagram, the integral, depends on the momentum. And so nothing forbids you to have a p squared log lambda term, and that's indeed what's happening. So you have a new divergence, which is absent at one loop. Okay. Now, for this diagram, for instance, this for loop diagram contains also a subdivergent diagram, and then there is a log diagram. And so you can check that, for instance, that these diagrams contains not only a log of lambda, but it contains a log of lambda plus a log of lambda squared, because this gives a log of lambda. If the momenta inside this subgraph are very big, this gives a log of lambda. And if the momenta inside the whole graph are all big, it gives another log of lambda. So you see, in general, a diagram with n loops will contain divergence log of lambda times the number of loops. So in general, you have log of lambda times the number of loops. Okay, so that's the general idea. So you have to work more in order to see whether this program of renormalization works out. So let's go back to this one. This new divergent term, in fact, means that in the propagator, in the two-point function, you must renormalize the coefficient which is in front of the p squared term. Yes?
So what we should do is like, because when we renormalize that one loop, we have fixed the a, b, and c, and then maybe the a, b, and c are not the good one for the two loop diagrams.
Yeah, so that's what I'm going. So what I'm going to say is that at two loop, you have new contribution, new terms in A, B, and C. Okay. And the question is, can we introduce new terms in A, B, and C so that all the logs and the logs disappear? And this theorem states that this is possible. It has been worked out. The logic, well, the proof is a bit complicated. There are various kind of proof, but it works.
How does that happen that we don't spoil the first loop corrections? If we modify the, they are a bit fine tuned for.
No, because remember, for instance, first the coefficient A was one. Remember at one loop. So this new divergence that occurs at two loop means that you expect that you must add the log of lambda term at two loop. So you are going now to introduce some gr squared times some coefficient, something, times log of lambda. Of course, log lambda divided by the renormalization scale. But you see that this correction is of order gr squared. So it will not change this diagram and this diagram. But it will add up to this diagram is of order G R squared, for instance. So if you add a contribution this order, well, rather this one. This one is over GR. So if you add, this is going to be to give a GR cube. So there is a combination. Okay. So similarly for B here, B, let's say this is a mass, so that's a bit special. But C, for instance, remember this was GR plus GR squared times another coefficient times log of lambda divided that we have computed. And then if you take into account this diagram, and this diagram, which is not very important, but basically these two kind of diagram, you get that you must add, well, another coefficient, let us write it by the square, that's some log of lambda divided by mu squared, and then you are going to have another coefficient, log of lambda divided by mu. Okay, and you can find such coefficients, and then you go to three loop order, etc., etc. So the theorem states that this is possible at all orders. But you must take into account the fact that you have those subdivergences. You must take them into account. And you must take into account that you might have, there is a technical difficulty, which is the fact that, for instance, this diagram is divergent, this subdiagram is divergent, and they share the same line. So there are technicalities associated with what is called overlapping divergence. But those are important points, but those are technical points. Moral is states that everything works. So I'm not going to explain more why, what is the deep reason why this works, but it is really, it's a better view to view this as a, from the point of view of Wilsonian renormalization. So why? So it works. Why does it work? The modern point of view and the modern proofs, in fact, rely on Wilson-like renormalization, which are equivalent, but which are easier to implement. Okay, so that's the first point. This was point one. Second point that I mentioned during one question, I don't want to go too slowly. Second point, the scale anomaly. So we have seen that the massless 5-4 theory is scale invariant. It means that if you rescale the field and rescale the distance, the actions doesn't change. So if you make a scale transformation on the classical solution of the 5-4 theory, massless, it stays a classical solution. It's a symmetry. So there is a symmetry. Okay. And this symmetry, in four dimensions, of course, in four dimensions. Okay. And the symmetry amounts to start from a field phi of x and changing into phi lambda of x, which is lambda phi of lambda x. So this is a symmetry. It's a global symmetry of the theory. And therefore, you have a current associated, which must be conserved. So it's an exercise to apply Noether theorem and to find that the current G mu or the scale invariance. Well, this is the this scale transformation are a mixture of transformation on the field and transformation of the coordinates. And in a field theory, when you make a transformation of the coordinates, it means that you are making local translation and rotation. So in fact, part of this conserved current is going to contain the generator of translation and rotation, namely they are going to contain the stress energy tensor theory. So this G mu scale, you can show that this is, so okay. So this, well, you work out, this G mu is T mu nu x nu plus, if I'm not mistaken, in two dimension, phi d mu phi, where T mu nu is a stress energy tensor, or if you prefer, the energy momentum tensor, which is T mu nu equal d mu phi d mu phi minus delta mu nu times the Lagrangian of the series, the Lagrangian density. This L is 1/2 of d phi squared plus g over factorial 4 phi 4. So these are the explicit result. Okay. So this current is conserved. And you can check that this current is conserved, namely d mu g mu scale invariant is 0. By using first the equation of motion of phi to the 4 and the fact that the stress energy tensor is 0, which is in fact also a consequence of the equation of motion of phi to the 4. This is translation invariance. Okay, so this is classically 0. And the reason why it's zero is that you can compute it, for instance, in dimension d, different from 4. And so, because in 4 dimensions, the theory is not scale invariant. Therefore, you can compute for the new scale, and you find that this is d minus 4 g divided by factorial 4 phi to the 4. That's just because this interaction term is not scale invariant, because now g has a dimension, we live in a dimension which is different from 4. Okay. And so you see that this classically differs, vanishes in 4 dimensions. Okay. This is classical. This is still classical. So, and using the equation of motion, you can also rewrite it in another way. Okay. So, why is it that? Why does this fail at the quantum level, the quantum theory? Okay. Well, this fails because if you do the calculation in the quantum theory for this object, this becomes a composite operator. Okay? So remember, when I discussed the quantization of the free field, I showed you that phi squared is something which is not, you have to be careful in defining what is this object in the quantum theory. So you have to use some normal order prescription and make it a normal order operator. The same thing occurs in the interacting theory for phi to the 4. You must define this in a precise way. It contains short distance singularity, which are in fact contained in those kind of diagrams, this one. Therefore, you have to renormalize the must be renormalized properly to be sensible quantum operator, an object whose matrix elements are finite. Okay. And if you do the calculation, you need to renormalize this operator, so you need to redo the theory of renormalization and define this properly. And what you find is, in fact, that this d mu, g mu scale, where now this is a quantum operator, so g mu is an operator, you found that this is nothing but the quantum properly defined phi 4 operator, but with a coefficient which is different from zero. So there is a quantum correction to this, which is zero. And it turns out that this is just the beta function divided by phi to the 4. So if you compute it at one loop, you find that this is g to the 4 with a coefficient g squared, g renormalized squared. So you see, so the beta, so this means that there is an anomaly. This classical symmetry where this is zero is spoiled by quantum effects. And the beta function is just measures this anomaly. So this is another definition of the beta function. The beta function, you can view it as the flow of renormalized effective coupling, but you can view it just as the coefficient. Yes?
Can you explain again why you wrote that?
Pardon?
Can you explain again why you wrote that?
Well, that's a result of the calculation.
Oh, OK, if you do explicitly.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can, that's a result of the calculation. I'm not going to do the calculation because then I would have to need to compute Feynman diagrams again, and I have no time. I prefer to speak about, but that's the result. At one loop, you find gr squared with the coefficient 3 over 5 4 squared times this phi score. And in fact, you can define the beta function also in this way. Okay? And that's a definition that extends to theory with several coupling constants. You have several coupling constants, you have several operators. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. It took me already 20 minutes. It's not working. This is terrible if it's not working. What should I do?
This one is not working.
Okay.
That's
it. Yes?
I have another question.
Yes?
So why does, is there any good reason for the beta function not to appear in other conserved currents?
Is there any reason for what?
For the beta function not to appear in other conserved currents, like in the stress energy tensor coverage?
Well, in general, if you have a symmetry, yes, you are right. You should ask the question. But so you have seen in QED that there is another symmetry for QED with massless fermions as a symmetry called the axial symmetry, which is also anomalous. Now, for the stress energy tensor, the energy momentum tensor, if it's not conserved, it means that translation invariance is broken. Which means that sometimes Lorentz, well, not only, so it's part of the Poincaré group. So if this is anomalous, then more in trouble. But I think there are models in string theory which have some gravitational anomalies, but in a local field theory, it must be Poincaré invariant in order to respect locality. So getting an anomaly for the stress energy tensor would be very bad. And it turns out that it's very difficult to obtain, to construct such a theory. But you are right. You should, each time that you have a symmetry, you should ask, do you have a good reason to think that it is not anomalous? And it turns out that there are no good reason for the scale invariance not to be anomalous, except in some very special.
How exactly do we make this ranking of symmetries, saying this symmetry must be?
I'm trying to rank them. I just, turns out that some symmetries are difficult to make anomalous and some are easier. But what he said is that it generically quantum effect spoils scale invariance unless you have, you are in a very special situation, or unless you have some very special additional symmetry. So for instance, in gauge series, in Young-Mill series, the scale invariance is also anomalous, except that if you had a lot of supersymmetry, so there is those famous n equals 4 super Young-Mill series with a maximal supersymmetry in four dimensions. Scale invariance is not anomalous because all the beta functions are zero. There are a lot of constellations, which is fermions and bosons, and there are more partners. Yes? Yes?
Does it ever occur that you have like a symmetry that doesn't hold on the classical level, but that crops up after taking into account quantum effects?
That it can be restored?
Anomaly, I guess.
Yes, in fact. Yes, because, well, we are going to see that in a minute. But consider the 5-4 theory in d equals 3. Then the beta function, this is a classical, you see that, this is a classical beta function. G, well, with some coefficient. Yes, no, this is this plus of order of gr of g squared. Okay? This is a classical result. Okay? So in d equals 4, you get minus gr. So the beta function for this starts like that. So the beta function is non-zero, except if the theory has no coupling, except if it's a free field. I'm sorry, you are in the back. I should have. Do you see it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't pay. OK. So 5-4, d equals 3. This is the beta function. This is a renormalized coupling. The beta function looks like that. The only fixed. The only point where the beta function is zero is when the coupling is zero, where therefore you recover the free field, which is scale invariant. But Wilson and Fisher in the theory of critical phenomena showed that for a theory which is equivalent to this quantum field theory, the beta function at one loop has a plus gr term. Here, there is another point where the beta function is zero. So at this specific point, you get scale invariance again. So if you are at the zero of the beta function, and this may occur, then you recover scale invariance.
So that only occurs at a certain like energy scale, yeah? Or momentum scale that you recover?
No, here that's for a very specific value of the coupling. When you vary, the energy scale by renormalization group argument, you move your effective couplings moves between this trivial fixed point and this non-trivial fixed point. And if you are at this specific coupling, there is no scale anomaly, so the effective coupling is fixed, it doesn't change. Changing the energy scale doesn't change the physics again, but because the theory is scale invariant at this point. You see?
And does that correspond to like a phase transition?
This is going to correspond to a phase transition, but when you vary the mass, which is another parameter, which is not the one I describe. Let me switch to Wilson. Wilsonian normalization. That's okay. So, what is Wilsonian renormalization, or renormalization group, if you prefer, versus perturbative renormalization group, namely the kind of equation that I called the Callan semantic, but okay, so I'm going to discuss that now. So I have 1 hour. So this should be enough, I hope. Okay. So remember, what was the strategy we had when doing perturbative renormalization? So let me just draw here a line that represents the energy scale of your theory. So we are in a high energy physics, so we try to construct a theory at a fixed mu renormalization scale of energy. And this mu corresponds to the energy scale at which we are in the physics we are interested in. That's 1 TeV if we are working at LHC. Okay, and either we introduce or we know that somewhere at a much higher energy scale where the physics has to be changed, there is an ultraviolet cutoff regulator, much bigger than this one, where the physics changes. And what we want to see, we want to construct a model that quantum field theory that doesn't depend on this. So we fix this, we have this, and we let it go to infinity. Because if there is a finite limit when this parameter goes to infinity, we know that it's not important. The detail of the physics at very high energy has no consequence on the physics of the energy we are interested in. Okay, so in high energy physics, mu fixed and lambda, we are interested in what's happening when lambda goes to infinity and want to prove that the limit exists. Okay. Now, in condensed matter, what you did with David was something different. You were interested in a theory which has a model of statistical mechanics, but it can be viewed as some kind of path integral when you read partition function, where you have a microscopic cutoff. So lambda now is 1 over A, the macroscopic cutoff, for instance, is the size of the atoms, the mesh of the lattice of the crystals you are studying, which is fixed, because you cannot change the physics except a few parameters. You can change the temperature, you can change the magnetic field you apply to your crystal, but you cannot change the mesh of your crystal. Okay. And you are interested in integrating over scale to get an effective, so this is a microscopic physics, microscopic physics, and you want to get an effective, what is the effective physics at a scale obtained by performing a rescaling transformation. So basically, you want to go at an energy scale, E, which is variable. So you want to move this E in this direction, in this direction. You see? So here, lambda is fixed. And E, which plays the same role as mu, is variable. And near a critical point where the physics at large distance becomes universal. You are interested in what's happening when E goes to zero to get the infrared limit. You see? But basically, that's the same picture, and I'm going to show this. In high energy physics, you have a model, you integrate over all the quantum fluctuations, but you are interested in what's happening this, and you want to get rid of this. While in high energy physics, you integrate over the thermal fluctuation in the system, which are analogous to the quantum fluctuation. You keep this fixed and you vary this. But basically, that's the same kind of question you are asking. Simply here you vary this, and here you vary this. Okay. So that's just, if you want, you can say, okay, that's a nice story, but does it make sense? So I'm going to try to show that this makes sense by looking at the 5-4 theory from the point of view of Wilsonian renormalization. Okay. So I'm going to see the renormalization of the scalar field. And a Wilson renormalization calculation. But I'm going to use what we have been told, so as a QFT method. Okay. So it's going to be not, in fact, different from what you did with David, but I hope you will recognize what I've been. Okay. So I'm going to study a theory which is slightly more general than phi to the 4. So I'm going to study a quantum field theory with an action, Euclidean. Okay. And, here I'm going to call the action A of phi because I'm going to perform a lot of renormalization group by scale factor, and in my notes I always call scale factor S for scale, and therefore calling the action S2 is a bit misleading. So the Euclidean action now is denoted A of phi, and I have a model in D dimension, and the action is due. So the Euclidean action is just this squared. And then I'm going to generalize the 5-4 model by taking a general potential. So V of phi is a more general potential. So for instance, I try to see what's happening if, for instance, V of phi is, contains coefficient, which are my notes. Let me just do this to be sure. I hope to know I have not written anything. Okay, let's divide it. That's, for instance, T divided by 2. Phi squared plus g divided by factorial 4 phi 4 plus some h divided, well, it's perhaps not a good. Okay. Well, let me write it rather coefficient. So this is going to be a coefficient c2, a coefficient c4, a coefficient c6, phi to the 6, plus etc. And I could even have a constant here. So this is the case, for instance, on even potential, but one can also consider potential which are not even, etc. So this is a general potential. And I have a model with a sharp momentum cutoff. So I consider that all the momenta are less than this capital lambda, as we did in the calculation. Okay. So this is our scalar field, and I'm trying to see what's happening if I want to define this is one, this is two, so this is my blackboard three. Okay, and so my functional integral for this model is, as usual, path integral d of phi exponential minus this action of phi. Okay, and here I integrate with the momentum lambda. I remember so all the k are less than lambda when I integrate over the fluctuation. So this is the same thing than the phi-4 theory, except that we have a finite cutoff, so we are somewhere here. And we may have more interaction terms, so we may have, so this is going to be a mass term, this is going to be a four vertex, this is going to correspond to a vertex with six legs, etc. More couplings, more interaction terms. Okay. And now I want to perform the renormalization a la Wilson. So I want to integrate. So I want to make a block spin transformation or a coarse graining. Operation by integrating over the fast modes. Of the model, namely, if I consider a field configuration which is a Fourier transform of phi of x in momentum space, I can separate it into phi 8 of k fast and phi of k slow, where the fast mode refers to the k between lambda and some lambda prime, less than lambda. And the slow modes refers to the mode k with momenta less than lambda prime. So I integrate. So this means that basically, in momentum space, I have a ball in momenta, and all the fields live in this ball. And instead, here I integrate over all the modes with the momenta. They live in this ball. And the coarse graining procedure consists in integrating only between lambda and lambda prime. Okay. So what Kadanoff and Wilson and Fisher told us is that we have to think that when we integrate only over the fast mode, if we integrate only over the fast mode, so if instead of integrating over this, so if we do something like integral over only of the fast mode, only, with momentum k between lambda and lambda prime, we get exponential of minus action, I'm sorry, the action for the fit. We get something that depends only on the slow modes, and we call this exponential of minus the effective action, or a prime of phi, or a prime of phi slow, or a prime of Phi's law is the effective action for the slow modes. Okay? So now we have an effective which can be complicated action for Phi slow, whose modes k live between 0 and lambda prime. So that's the result of the step of the first step of coarse grading. Okay? And then this is step one. Step two. Rescale the momenta and the field fields so that so that we write now that my k is equal, the original k here is now some k prime. And so that when k is equal to lambda prime, k is equal to lambda. So this is just k equal k prime lambda divided by lambda prime. I'm sorry. Lambda prime divided by lambda. And phi slow is now redefined as some lambda prime divided by lambda with some something that I have to check time phi prime. So that this can be rewritten as exponential of minus a, but I have a prime, so let me keep this a effective. The effective action once for the slow mode, that this is a prime of phi prime, where now phi prime lifts momenta k prime less than lambda. And so phi prime is what is called the renormalized field. And this is a prime. Phi prime is called the renormalized action after the coarse grading step. And then we iterate. So this is step one, step two, and step three. Iterate so that we integrate a bit in, then we iterate until we reach the energy scale E we are interested in. Okay, so that's the general strategy. So David made, I think, presented you a calculation in the using some approximation and for a 5-4 theory, and I'm going to use a similar but slightly more general approximation for a general potential V. Okay, so I'm going to use what is called the local potential approximation. And I'm not going to justify exactly all the approximation I'm doing, but this can be justified in a formulation of Wilsonian renormalization group, which is a variant, which is called the renormalized effective potential method, which is something that is developed by a German physicist called Wetterich, but I think it goes back to and his collaborator, which is one variant of Wilsonian renormalization group. So basically, there are two methods. This renormalized effective potential method that is due to Wetterich and his collaborator, but which is related, but shown to be equivalent to the method of the renormalized effective action, which is the original version due to Wilson, Kadanoff, and which has been made more formal in the 80s by a high energy physicist called Joe Polchinski, whose name I think you are going to be familiar because he made and is making very important contributions in string theory. There is a famous book by Joe Polchinski about string theory. And he's one of the discoverers of the brain, etc. So, but okay, so I'm going to just to show you a receipt not justified to compute. What is this effective action? What is A prime of phi prime if we integrate? Okay. How can we integrate over this momentum shell? Okay, so we are just, well, the basic idea is just to start from the fact that if we start from an action A of phi, which is a microscopic action, we know that the wall loop effective action, gamma of phi, that we computed two lectures ago, which basically consists in seeing what's happening to you when you integrate over all the momenta, is the original action, A of phi, plus 1/2, this is a one loop result, of the trace of the log of the second derivative of phi. Okay? Now, so here A phi is a background field. So now replace, so this is, I'm not, think about phi as phi slow and assume that it is slowly varying. I'm going to do unwaving arguments, but they can be made rigorous. So let me assume that in the action phi as a kinetic term, I keep the kinetic term here. But here, I assume that locally, phi is a constant. Okay. This term, remember, we discuss it in the phi 4 theory in general. But we can extend. So for this action, for A of phi equals this plus this, what is, so if A is 1/2 of d phi squared plus phi of phi, what is the Hessian? It's a second derivative of the action with respect to variation of phi. So it's a differential operator. It's an operator which has a kernel. it's a trace classical. What is its kernel? Its kernel is the second derivative of this, which is just minus the Laplace operator. And this is like phi to the 4. So you have to take the second derivative of this. So this is this plus the second derivative of the function phi at phi. So instead of multiplying by phi squared, I multiply by the second derivative of v here. And let's keep it here. Wait. So the second derivative of phi is obviously c2 plus c4 divided by 2 phi squared plus c6 divided by factorial 4 phi 4 plus etc. Okay. So here we replaced the terms that we had for the phi 4 theory by this more general term. This is Laplace of Laplace differential operator. And this is just a multiplication by a function of x. Okay. And so now, if we consider phi as a constant, what is this object? So in this approximation, what we consider that phi here is constant. What is the trace log? We have seen the trace log. Minus, so we have to compute the trace log of minus the Laplacian plus the second derivative of some constant field phi. The trace is the integral of a dx of the x matrix element, and the log is the log of this operator. Minus delta plus. Okay. Now, if this can be treated as a constant, so namely constant in the neighborhood of x, then what we get is we can just take a Fourier transform of this and write this as integral dx. And this is just integral over d dk divided by 2 pi to the power t, the log of k squared plus the second derivative of phi. Okay. And of course, we integrate when the momenta k are less than the cutoff. So this is a finite integral because we have a cutoff. Okay. So now, so this is 3, this is, oh no, no, I had 1, 2. So this, yeah, this is 4. This is 5. Okay. So this is an approximate formula for this whole term. You see? So now a good guess. I cannot use this, so well, I think I can forget about this. Okay, so let me. Yeah. No, so that's not what I want to do. I should. This is your rear, so the rear.
Question.
Yes.
The integral over x should disappear, right?
Pardon?
The integral over x shouldn't be there, right?
It is there.
Yeah, but when you Fourier transform, you pick up two integrals over p, and then the x dies turning.
No, I get only one integral over k.
I mean, you're.
basically you're just taking a trace in the k-basis over there, right? So there shouldn't be two integrals.
Yes. Yes, but if you take a trace on the k-basis, you are still going to have an integral over x, because the k eigenmodes are plane waves, so they are not normalized. And the normalization is precisely the volume of space. So if you want to be sure, work on a finite lattice. So that you are going to have both a finite number of k and a finite number of x with a proper normalization, take the continuum limit and you are going to get this. You see? Another way to say that, I think, is that this has to be dimensionless. So it has contained both an integral over x and an integral over k in order to have a global integral which is dimensionless.
Yeah.
That's more justification than a proof, but that's explained what it is. See, or if you want, you can see that this is some kind of integral of a phase space.
Yeah, it's very easy.
Which is dimensionless.
Put in two momentum identities, you can see it.
Yeah, there is a delta. Basically, this relies on the fact that, for instance, the delta function of zero in momentum space is infinite because it's an integral of a space. In the same way that the integral, the delta function in momentum space equals zero, is infinite because the integral of a momenta. And if you work on a finite lattice, this is going to be the number of points in the lattice, the size of the lattice, and this is going to be the size of the Brillouin zone, and everything is finite. Okay? Okay. Oops. Okay. So. So now I'm going to use this calculation here as a justification for the following ansatz for the effective action. So this is blackboard number six. So I use this as an ansatz for A effective of phi slow. You see that this is a classical action. This is the contribution of the fluctuation, of the quantum fluctuation in the one loop approximation. And this contribution is a sum over all the momenta. So a good guess is to say that if integrating over all the momenta, you integrate over a momentum shell, you take the same result, but integrate only under the momentum shell. So on that, A effective of phi slow is the original action of phi slow plus 1/2 integral d dx integral over d dk divided by 2 pi to the power d, but now for the momenta between lambda and lambda prime of this log of k squared plus double prime of var. And since I'm considering the phi slow, they are still varying slowly with x. So I introduce the dependent. So you see, I integrate over each point, and in the vicinity of each x point, I treat phi slow as if it was a constant. So I approximate phi slow, which is slowly varying, as being a constant at some point, and I integrate over the k fast. I integrate rather on the phi of k fast, as if phi slow was constant. So there is a lot of approximation. Okay, so this is log of k squared of the second derivative of phi slow at point x. Okay, so this is an ansatz. So let's see if it works. It can be justified by this method, but I'm not going to discuss that. So take it as an ansatz, but I hope this ansatz has been at least makes some sense. No, that's not my note. Okay. So now, of course, what I'm going to do is that. Where is it? Yeah. Okay. I'm going to write to integrate over a small momentum shell. So I'm going to take that lambda prime is lambda times 1 minus some delta something. Let's call it delta of little s. Okay. Delta of little s. Small with respect to 1. So I'm integrating over a small momentum shell. So if I integrate over a small momentum shell, of course, I can consider this just as a volume of the sphere. So I can rewrite this as a phi slow plus 1/2 integral dx times, and then I integrate over. So I get a lambda to the power d divided 2 pi to the power d. I have a delta s, because it's a multiplicative renormalization. And I have a coefficient, which is the volume of the sphere in dimension d space, so which is something which is just, I never remember the formula, but that's some coefficient. Let's call it the volume of the unit sphere of dimension d minus 1. Sphere in RD. So this is the sphere of dimension d minus 1. And then I have the log. And of course, since I'm integrating between k between lambda and lambda minus something very small, I just get lambda squared. Okay. So this is, I have no, not, be careful about the integral. Well, this can be done for finite integral. But you, okay. So you see that A slow is just the original action. So there is a kinetic term here and a potential term. And then there is the contribution of the fluctuation, which is just an integral over x of some function that depends only on phi slow at point x. So instead of having an effective action, which is complicated, all the modification of the effective action are incorporated in a modification of the potential. So this can be written just as, so A effective of phi slow is just integral d dx, 1/2 of d phi slow squared plus v effective of phi slow. So we have just a renormalization of the local potential. So we have a local normalization. Of the local potential only. Hence the name of the approximation, local potential approximation. Okay, and this is the new potential. So V effective slow is the original potential. V effective is just the original potential V plus 1/2 lambda d divided by 2 pi to the power d. And then there is a small variation, so it is plus delta s. So it's a small variation, and then I have this volume of s d minus 1 log of lambda squared plus the second derivative of the original potential. OK? So we get something very simple. OK? So now we have to perform the third step, or the second step. We have to rescale the momenta and the field. And we have to rescale the momenta and the field in such a way that the momenta becomes again bounded by lambda. And we don't want the original kinetic term to be changed. You see? So step two. Rescale phi, slow, and the momenta. So the k and the x. OK. So we have to adjust. And well, if we change phi and x by some term, this is going to change this coefficient by something of order delta s. But this is not going to change this by a factor delta s, because this is already a factor delta s. Okay. So, well, in the notes is written what is the coefficient. But at the end of the day, I get that what I called V, this, after that, I get a new field phi and a new potential renormalized potential, which I am just going to write. So the renormalized potential, I'm not choosing exactly the same. So phi is not phi slow. It's just now phi slow rescaled in the proper coordinates. This is just, well, the original potential, V of phi, plus ds, this small variation here of the prime. And then I get a term which is d times v of phi. This comes just from the renormalization rescaling of x here. I get a minus d minus 2 over 2 times phi v prime of phi. This comes from the rescaling of phi. And then I get the non-trivial term here, which is of the form, let me draw this just by coefficient a times log of 1 plus the second derivative of v with respect to phi. Okay, so this is the important contribution. This comes from the rescaling of X. Rescaling of X's, and this comes from the rescaling of phi. Okay. And in fact, this D and this D minus 2 over 2 are just correspond to the canonical dimension of the volume element and of the field in the free theory. They do not depend on V. And remember, we have seen that in order to have an action here, a classical action of the form integral over space of 1 half D of phi squared, if the volume element has a dimension of a length to the power D, phi must have the dimension of a length to the power 2 minus D divided by 2. This is just the fact that if the canonical dimension of X is a length, canonical dimension of phi is a length to the power 2 minus d divided by 2. So this term is just classical, and this is a quantum one loop contribution. Okay? So now you can iterate this equation. This was just an equation when you integrate by a factor, infinitesimal factor, little s. Okay? So once you have this, let me forget about the scale anomaly. I don't need it anymore. I hope it's working. So now, step three, we iterate this infinitesimal renormalization group transformation. Iterate to get from scale lambda to a scale lambda divided by s. To go from lambda to lambda divided by s, where s is a scale factor, which is now bigger than 1. So basically, s is this 1 plus delta s to the power n, where this is small and this is big, and therefore this can be over the 1 or much bigger than 1. Yes?
See the ds on that board? Is that delta s or dimension times s?
That's delta s, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you, ma'am. This is delta s. Yes, this is delta s. This is a delta s, which is, yeah, no, thank you very much. This is a delta s, okay? And you see that now the delta s is going to be just a logarithmic derivative, the variation of log of the capital S. So you can rewrite this, but that's equivalent to this as, you assume that now your renormalized potential depends on phi and on s under a scale transformation. And you can write, so let me just this write this V capital S of phi. And the equation becomes just that the variation of this V renormalized minus V is the variation. So this is going to be just the logarithmic derivative with respect to the macroscopic scale factor V of S, phi, is just this term evaluated at phi of S. So this is D times Vs, phi plus 2 minus D divided 2 phi times D V prime. So this is D over D phi, let's say, of Vs of phi. This is the derivative of V with respect to the variable phi. So I rewrite this as the second derivative with respect to first derivative with respect to phi. And then you have this coefficient, which is this number A times the logarithm of lambda squared plus the third derivative of Vs of phi divided by phi squared. Okay? And I can rescale V so that lambda is set to 1, because now lambda is fixed, remember, lambda is fixed, so we can express everything in units of momenta which are 1, so I can replace this by 1. And this is the final normalization group flow equation. So this is the renormalization group flow equation in the space of potential. V of phi. So it's an equation that is a flow in an infinite dimensional space of potential. Yes?
Why the 1 becomes lambda squared and then again 1? The 1 in the bracket?
That's because, in fact, I did already this approximation when I wrote this here. Yeah, so I'm sorry. Yeah. Here, this is the lambda squared. I'm sorry. I just copied the formula from my book. So here, this is lambda squared. But either you set lambda equal 1, so you walk in momentum expressed in units of the cutoff, or you do it at the end. Anyway, this formula is the same as this one. Okay. So you get this equation. And now, well, I have, well, let's say 10 minutes. So yeah, maybe. Okay. Well, apparently it's time to show some equations, so I hope I have. Thank you. Okay. I've written this on the blackboard, but so now I'm just going to take a particular form of the potential here with the phi squared, the phi 4, and the phi 6 term, expand in phi, and see what this equation corresponds to for the coefficients. Okay, so what is, yeah, okay. So this is with slightly different notation. What we have, I start from an action. Well, phi is the original field, and so this is the local potential. Phi b means bare field, but don't care, I'm okay. So at the end, I get up with this equation that I wrote, and this is the form of the equation in 4 dimensions. Here you have d equal 4, and here you have 2 minus d divided by 2 equal minus 1. So this is the equation in dimension 4. Okay, and this is a rescaling. Okay, so keep this equation in mind. This is the equation I wrote here. And now I expand the potential to order phi 6. The previous equation here, that is written here, I expand it in powers of phi. Of course, this will contain, I expand the log with phi squared, etc. So I'm going to take terms of order phi 8, phi 10, etc. But I truncate, so I made another approximation. I truncate this equation to order phi 6. And so the renormalized potential, if I truncate the renormalized potential to order phi 6, is going to have exactly the same form, except that the coefficient of the phi 2, phi 4, and phi 6 term will now depend on the scale factor. So T is replaced by some T of S, G is replaced by some G of S, and the new term H, which is for phi, is replaced by H of S. Okay? And so this, the equation that I wrote before, can be rewritten as a flow equation for those coefficients. So here is the flow equation for the coefficient of phi 4. Here is the flow equation for phi squared, for the phi 4 coefficient. And here is the flow equation for the phi 6 coefficient. So you do a bit of algebra, which amounts just to expand the log of something plus something. And you get this equation. So you see, there is a mixing between G, H, and T, which is non-trivial. Okay. And I denote this variation minus the beta function of T, because as I said, this is going to correspond to the beta function in the renormalization group calculation. Okay. So you find, and you see that the important fact is that the linear term for T that comes just not from the loop expansion is here 2. Here there is no, and here is minus 2, because the 2 corresponds to the canonical dimension in terms of mass of the T coefficient. T is a mass squared, so there is a 2. Here there is no G squared term in 4 dimensions because G is dimensionless. And here there is a minus 2H for the phi 6 coefficient, because in 4 dimensions, H has a dimension of a mass to the power minus 2. Okay. And then you have corrections, which are a bit complicated. But you may be interested in seeing what's happening when you are close to the Gaussian theory. So when T is small, massless theory, G is small, weakly interacting theory, H is small. So then you can expand in powers again. And so basically you get this term plus this term. You get this term for G squared, and you get additional term for G cubed. And the important point is this term. You recognize here you get minus 3 G squared divided by 4 pi squared. So this coefficient is just minus the coefficient of the beta function that we got in perturbation theory. And it turns out that this term here is a term that corresponds to the term I have wrote for the one-loop renormalization of the mass in the massive theory, just at the end of last lecture. I don't have to detail, but we recover precisely the results of the perturbation theory calculation when the couplings are small, the parameters are small. So we get minus the beta function of the phi 4 theory. So, and this just reflects the fact that this fact. Yesterday, I did a calculation in this direction. Today, I did a calculation in this direction. But in any cases, I took into account the effect of the modes between here and here yesterday, and the contribution of the modes between here and here today. But this is the same calculation. And therefore, this explains why this flow equation, when you go from here to here, corresponds to the beta function for the the quantum energy when you integrate from here to here. You take into account the effect of the high energy modes going down to top and here going from top to down. Okay. And, well, let me finally show you in 1 minute. Well, I have this picture is a bit difficult to explain. Okay, so now, So let's neglect the phi 6 term. So I take into account only, I assume that the phi 6 term is zero, and I take into account only the T term, which is a phi square coupling, and the G term, which is a phi 4 coupling. And I integrate, so I draw the flow when I change S. So this is a vector field, and basically the each arrow is a vector whose components are the beta function for T and the beta function for G. This is the G phi 4 coupling, this is the T coupling. And the flow, remember, the T coupling add a plus 2t plus a correction. So this means that if t equal, is not equal to zero here, you flow in this direction or in this direction. So if the theory is massive, it becomes more massive at large distance. Okay, and the beta function for g is positive, which means that the flow, which is minus beta, is negative, so it goes to g equals zero. So this is the flow in the TG parameter plane goes like this in four dimensions. Okay, and I think that if you there is one line where if you are on this line, you flow towards the points where G equals zero and T equals zero, which corresponds to the free field theory. So there is one subspace in the parameter space where you flow to what's called the Gaussian fixed point. And if you are not on this line, either you flow to the massive theory or you flow to the theory with a negative mass term, namely a potential which has two minima. So there are the two massive phases. So you recognize in this substance a mixture of quantum field theory and the Wilsonian normalization, the flow in critical phenomena. Here you have a critical surface, and here you have two massive phases. Okay. And finally, let me show you something interesting. I'm assuming that I am on a critical surface, so T, the theory is always massless. So this is a flow where I'm drawing the renormalization group flow for the massless theory. I'm the critical surface, so T is adjusted so that the theory is massless. But I take into account both the phi 4 coupling and the phi 6 coupling. So G is non-zero, but H is also non-zero. Okay? And remember, the beta function for phi 4 is positive, but with a G squared term, which means that when G is small, the beta function is negative but small. It's not linear in G, which means that the flow goes toward G equals zero, but slowly, while the beta function for the phi 4 coupling, which is called H, is minus H, so it's over the H, but with a minus sign, which means that the flow is attractive. So what happened? You see that if you start from a theory where you have both a phi 4 coupling and a phi 6 coupling, the phi 6 coupling, the renormalized phi 6 couplings, go very quickly to zero, while the phi 4 couplings goes to zero, but slowly. So if you are somewhere in a space of theory here, where you had a 5-6 coupling, very quickly, where you are interested in the low energy physics, the 5-6 couplings goes to zero, and you can forget about it. While when you go from there to there, from there to there, the 5-4 couplings vary, but much more slowly. So in other words, you are attracted towards the line where the 5-6 coupling is zero and the 5-4 coupling is non-zero. Okay? So this explains why, when you are interested in quantum field theory, where this cutoff is very, very large, it's enough to consider a theory with a 5-4 coupling. The 5-6 coupling and the 5-8 coupling, etc., have this property, so they are called to be strongly irrelevant, so you can neglect them. So when you are interested in high energy physics, no need to take into account those irrelevant terms in the possible action of the theory. You can keep with 5-4, which is a renormalization theory. And one last remark, the flow are such that even if you start from a theory with H positive, so that the potential is bounded from below, but with G negative, with 5-4 coupling negative, so it could be, it could mean a potential which is something like that, but something complicated, with many minima. The flow are such that first H increases, then until G becomes positive, then it decreases. And anyway, even if you start from a point which seems to be very non-perturbative, you end up on this line, and you end up on the renormalizable 5-4 theory. Okay. So it's just an exercise of calculation. It has to be, calculation has to be improved, but this is a general philosophy. So the general philosophy is that Wilson perturbative renormalization or Wilson has the same calculation, simply going from there to there or going from there to there, and you recover the same renormalization group functions. Simply in Wilson theory, you have renormalization group flow in the whole space of coupling, while in quantum field theory, you are only interested in the renormalization group coupling on this attractive line where the theory is renormalizable. You can neglect all the irrelevant term in the action. So this was fast, but I hope you got the idea. Thank you. And okay, the detail of the calculation are in the notes, if you found that this went a bit too fast. And I am here, so if you have questions, please come.